Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. We are living through an unprecedented moment in the history of the free press. It's never been done before, this thing that is happening right now in Canada, this thing that has been happening for the last 2 years. Other countries are considering it. Canada is actually doing it. We have crossed a line that was considered holy for like over 100 years, the line that separates the press from the government. The relationship reporters are supposed to have with governments is adversarial, on purpose and by design. They try to conceal info, we try to reveal it. They try to use their power and do things without having to explain why, we demand answers. Doesn't always actually happen that way in practice, but that has always been the idea. And to protect that idea, it has always been thought that the press must be independent. You hear those words together a lot, the independent press. But you can't be independent from somebody who pays you an allowance. You can't be independent from somebody whose money you rely on to live. You can't be independent from someone who you literally depend on for survival. But that is exactly what we're currently trying to do. And that is absolutely fascinating. Whatever else it is, whatever opinions I may have about it, it is really fucking interesting to be a media reporter in a country that is conducting this unprecedented experiment in the history of the free press. 2 years ago, the federal government started to roll out several streams of support: tax breaks, newsroom wage subsidies, a $600 million ongoing plan to save the news media from bankruptcy. The Trudeau government pushed past the debates, past the philosophical and academic discussions about lofty ideals of press independence, all of that. They moved into the practical application of permanent news subsidies. No need to speculate, no need to hypothesize about what that might do to the press. Now I can report on what it is doing. Except I can't. I can't because they're not telling us. They promised that they would tell us. Here is Evan Solomon interviewing Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez back in 2019.
Will you promise to make every decision this advisory group makes and the next group makes transparent in terms of how your government decides, who is what your government calls a qualified journalistic organization, and why they got the money? Will all that be transparent and no secrecy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All the recommendations. They'll be making recommendations on a lot of things. 100% of the recommendations, as you were asking, will be public. But it's really important that we do so, and we will.
That seemed pretty definitive to me. But Evan Solomon wanted to make super-duper sure that there was no wiggle room in there.
What I want to know what's public is the applications. People want to know, whatever media organization applies for money from this $600 million fund, will the applications be public and the decision as to who gets the money and who doesn't and why, will that be public?
Yes, I think, yes.
And yet, no. No, we do not know who applied. No, we don't know who got in. No, we don't know how much money those who did get in are receiving from the government. And it's not that we're waiting for the promised transparency, waiting, as is so often the case, for the slow-moving wheels of bureaucracy to deliver on the government's promise. No. What happened is, somewhere along the way, they went back on that promise. This stuff is now officially a secret. There are a few cases in which news organizations themselves have provided answers, usually in the case of public companies that have to disclose this kind of stuff. And we do know the names of some of the news organizations that got into the program. We don't know anything else about how much money they're getting or any of that, but we do know some names because in those cases, the names of the news organizations have to be disclosed in order for the subscribers of those news companies to get a tax write-off. But the majority of the information, and the most important information, is being kept confidential by the government. Of course, there is another potential way that reporters could find out answers to these questions about Canadian news organizations. We could just ask them. And so we did. Canada Land asked 77 news organizations to disclose their status. Are they participating with the media bailout? And if so, how? And the way that this works, by the way, is first, a news organization applies for QCJO status. That is government status as a qualified Canadian journalism organization. That's the first gate. That's the one where the government's board of journalism experts read your company's news stories and they decide if you are worthy. But getting that status all by itself doesn't get you any money. It's just the first step. Once you have QCJO status, then you can apply for other programs like the main one, the wage subsidy, or the ability to give your subscribers tax receipts. There's other things as well. So yes, we wrote to 77 news organizations asking them to disclose their QCJO status and more, and three of them replied to us with answers. I can understand why. I get why the other 74 said nothing. I might not respect it, but I do understand it. I mean, who wants to put up their hand and say, yeah, us over here, our newsroom receives hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars a year from Canadians, whether Canadians want to or not, they are paying us to produce our news stories. Please proceed to harass us on Twitter accordingly. I get why they don't want to say that. Or even worse, who wants to put up their hand and say, yeah, over here, we want it in. We were dying to take millions of dollars from the same government that we report on. But they rejected us because they deemed our editorial standards too low. Neither of those disclosures, whether you got in or whether you were shut out, neither of them really would help build a news organization's credibility or their trust with the public. Which is one of the reasons why Canada Land has not pursued this government funding. If we have nothing to hide or to be embarrassed about, then we can be free to report. That was the idea anyhow, but we can't report information we don't know. Who does know? Answers to our questions are determined by a board of just five people. Five news experts who were appointed by a panel that was appointed by the government. This board meets in secret, and they make decisions about who is worthy and who is not. You cannot go online to watch videos of their secret board meetings. They don't publish transcripts. They don't publish minutes. They do not publish the results. But their chairperson, Colette Brin, a journalism professor, has agreed to give me an interview. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Jason Cherry, Renaud Emond, Michael Phillips, Graham Hattersley, Matt Daly, Ashley Deneen, John Mays, and Willie Costello.
I'm Willie, a data scientist in Bracebridge, Ontario, and I support Canada Land because it's the best way for me to keep up with what's really going on in this country. I love the main show, I love Shortcuts, I love the deep dive investigative series like Commons and White Saviors, and I love the fact that this year, listener support has helped fund Canada Land Back with Ryan McMahon, as Thunder Bay remains one of the best pieces of audio journalism I've ever heard.
Listen, I really want to thank you for speaking with me today, because there's so little that's been reported or documented about how it's actually playing out in real life.
I'm really glad to be here. This is a process that has some confidentiality to it because it's tax information. And so the whole board were thoroughly briefed on what that means in terms of not being able to provide certain types of information. And of course, we're all basically journalists, so we would all love to say everything that we do, but we are not able to, unfortunately. But I can certainly speak to the process as it concerns the board itself. So what we do is really look at a very small piece of an organization's application, which is a small but important piece as regards the practice of journalism itself.
It's the crucial piece.
Okay, well, that's the big question. What is journalism? Which I hope we don't have to answer. We don't see ourselves as being the journalism police or the journalism popes or whatever. We're not determining what is journalism and what isn't journalism, but what is the kind of journalism that is really targeted with this program?
Okay, I think we have to get into that, because though you're just one piece of the puzzle, the beating heart of this, the part that was so thorny and controversial of like, at some point, if you're going to be subsidizing journalists, you've got to decide who qualifies. We may differ on this, but I think that maybe does involve deciding who is a journalist and who isn't. What is the process? If a news organization wants to be given this government stamp of qualified Canadian journalism organization, what do they have to do?
Well, the three criteria that we look at are they engaged in the production of original news content. So original news content is considered to be general interest, including the coverage of democratic institutions and processes, not strictly that. And when we talk about news, it means it's not primarily opinion, not primarily entertainment or lifestyle, and it's not targeted to a specific industry. So if you're doing like a magazine just about skiing, well, that's not going to be considered original news content as defined by the Act. Mm-hmm. So that's the first piece. And if you're also doing a lot of kind of aggregating and reproducing news releases or content from other news organizations, that's not going to be considered original either. And of course, anything that's advertorial or promotional. So that's the biggest part of what we do, of what we look at. And then there's the regular employment of at least two journalists, which work at arm's length from the organization. And that's very fiscal expertise talk to say that they're not shareholders or owners of the organization, or they don't have a personal relation to someone who is in that situation. So they're not married to or father or parent or sister or brother.
The point of the board is that these are journalism experts. One part that you are responsible for is determining if the employees are journalists or not. How do you determine who is a journalist and who isn't?
That's a really tricky one, actually, because the original news content determines whether journalism is being done or the kind of journalism that is supported by this program. And then we compare what the content that is journalism and the employees, the list of employees that is provided by CRA. So we say, yes, these people are doing journalism. But of course, we're not giving out ID cards or press passes or anything like that. It's really kind of a general assessment that, yes, there is journalism being done here. And it's a pretty broad definition. We're very aware of debates, legislative and even philosophical debates about how do you define who is a journalist. So someone who does, for instance, a layout, editing, all kinds of different things, not just reporters, photographers, videographers. These people are considered journalists in a very broad sense.
But if a publisher says, I've got these two employees, your job is to determine they have to be journalists for you to get the QCGO status. So you're not going through their CVs or looking at whether they went to journalism school.
No.
So what are you doing? How are you determining if
so? As I just tried to explain, we look at the content and we say, yes, there is original news content being done by this organization, and the list of employees and their titles. And we see that they are either writing and reporting, or they are doing other things such as layout or photography or editing. So it's a very broad, we don't get into individual CVs or education or anything like that.
Essentially, if it's journalism, it was made by a journalist for your purposes.
Yes.
So that takes us to, is it journalism, which is the bulk of what you do?
Is it original news content? Is it original news content?
Okay.
So there is a lot of journalism not being supported by this program. This is a targeted program aiming at original news content, which is general interest and includes the coverage of democratic institutions and processes. So you could say that a magazine, a business magazine targeting a specific industry, that's journalism. But it's not the kind of journalism that's being supported by this program. You could say opinion advocacy journalism is journalism, but it's not the kind of journalism that's being supported by this program. It's a choice that was made by the legislator.
I know that The Logic, which is a business publication, they have QCGO status.
Yes.
The Narwhal is...
I'm not allowed to say who does and who doesn't, but if organizations have publicly said that they're getting it, well,
yeah,
they're not lying.
They've said so. And the Narwhal is specific. It's environmental reporting. So there are...
Yeah. So those are really good examples because they were considered, and I think because they did say so publicly, I think it's okay for me to say that we do consider publications or organizations that do deal with a certain type of news, but through a pretty broad lens in the sense of, and that's really exactly the language that we use in our assessments. So it's a wide lens, the innovation economy and the environment, to use those two examples, are pretty broad. Like The Logic is not just about the tech industry, and it's not just for the tech industry. And the Narwhal, they do have a broad view of issues, but it's a very diverse and very journalistic in the sense that they do a lot of field work and independent reporting.
I wouldn't be arguing that they should be excluded. And so far, I think...
No. These are good examples to show that the interpretation can be pretty broad.
And it seems like your board has been taking a pretty broad interpretation. For the purposes of this program, if you're making journalism, you're a journalist. And for the purposes of this program, what is general, what is original news content? It can be about the environment. It can be about business. You've been pretty open.
Yeah.
What are you close to? What is disqualifying? And you don't read everything when a news organization submits, right? Like you have to take a sampling of their stuff.
Yeah, for sure. It's a lot of work. I mean, just going through typically 3 weeks of content, because we do want to make sure that the content is, the engagement in news production is ongoing. It's not something like just, oh, it's a couple of days before the election and or a week before the election, and now we're getting interested in general interest news, but the rest of the time, we're just doing advertorial. So advertorial, of course, is excluded. Anything that's really just straight opinion with no reporting or just, you know, opinion advocacy, that's not going to disqualify an organization that they are doing opinion, they are publishing opinion. But if there's no news, there's no firsthand reporting, you know, another type of content that's not considered is direct reproduction or very light adaptation of news releases or content from other news sources.
Sure.
And of course, if you're not attributing that content to the source, well, that's also a red flag.
I understand that there's some pretty obvious exclusions for, like you say, advertorial, or if it's just like a lobby group has its own newsletter, that's pretty easy to spot.
Yeah, and the lobby group is actually, that would be like the third criteria that we look at, that they're not significantly producing content that is promotional or reporting on a specific organization or association.
Yeah.
So if it's the publication of a lobby group, and they're basically just writing about their interests or their activities, well, then that's not going to qualify. But we haven't really received applications of that nature. I think people understand that.
So there are finer points, though, in terms of the guidance that's been provided to you, where you are getting involved in judgment calls about quality of journalism. As I understand it, you do have to create some sort of a threshold as to whether they're doing the job well or not. Is that not accurate?
To a certain extent, again, I would say that our assessment is very broad. For example, we're not going to check that every piece has three different sources from different perspectives. There's a lot of single source material out there. We're not getting into that. Some of these organizations have very small newsrooms, sometimes a single person. You're not doing a lot of like hard-hitting journalism, and that's fine.
According to your first annual report, you had 157 news organizations apply and just five of you on this board. So, like, you're reading a lot of news.
Well, I'm glad you realize that. It is a lot of work.
How many were rejected?
We're not allowed to say.
You're not allowed to
say? We're not allowed. And we were hoping to provide those numbers in the report. But what I can say, I think, I hope, is that there is a process that we developed in the second year for decision review. So we did do some decision reviews this year. So in those cases, there were initial assessments. Well, actually, our assessment is non-binding. It's the minister who issues the decision. But the decision was negative. Uh-huh. And so there was a decision review. And we were involved in that as well. So we redid the process, but with different content. And yeah, so I don't think I can go any further than that. But there is a possibility that a negative decision can be rescinded or reviewed, or anyway, that we can go from a negative to a positive decision.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer. And it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. Professor Byrne, why can't you tell me the names of it's not your rule, but can you explain the rule to me? Why the former Heritage Minister, when asked about this, said that the entire process was going to be transparent, but you can't tell me the names of who applied, the names of who's rejected. You can't even tell me the number.
No, well, the names are tax information. Names of organization, that's very clear in the Income Tax Act, that the names of applicants are actually protected information.
Why?
It's in the Tax Act. I mean, you're going to have to take that up with the Minister of Revenue and the people at the CRA. That's really not, I can't change the Income Tax Act. That's the way it is.
I'm not asking you to change it. I'm just, basically, Canadians were told that this is all going to be transparent, and now we learn that we are paying out of public funds for original news content to be produced. It's subsidized just like the CBC is.
Yeah.
But we can't know who's getting that. And if the news organization decides not to tell us, we'll never know what news we're paying for. I know it's not your rule, but do you understand why?
Yeah. And I would say that it's even possible that organizations which have been very critical of this program are actually QCGOs.
Well, we know that they are.
But they're not saying it.
Well, Post Media had to say it because they're a public company. So they spent years
criticizing this, and then they are one of the biggest beneficiaries of it, and we know that because they.
Well,
have,
I think Post Media. I mean, there were columnists at Post Media who were criticizing it, but it wasn't the organization itself. So that's fine. But I'm saying that some organizations, not yours, Jesse, but some organizations are actually taking a position against this program.
Wait, you're saying, hold on a second.
But anyway.
You're saying that there are news organizations that have been bashing this program, secretly taking money from it?
I'm saying it's possible.
Is the rebel? You can't tell me.
I don't know if they do or not, because I don't know where that process is.
Okay, well, that part we should clarify for people. I'm not holding you responsible for this secrecy, but I think...
No, but it's an interesting question because, you know, there's this idea in the Income Tax Act that the identity of a taxpayer should not be disclosed by the CRA and not by us either. But in this specific case, because of the nature of the tax credit, because it is journalism, because there is a need for transparency, should there be an exception? And I'm not a tax law expert, but as a journalism professor, I would say, and as someone who's interested in journalism policy, I would say, well, maybe this is a case where there should be an exception.
Maybe.
But I'm not going to say that as chair of the board, because obviously that's not my role. You understand that I'm like caught between these different...
I do.
I'd have to change my hat.
Yeah, but as a journalism professor, look, you know, like the government paid for a research report called the Shattered Mirror Report. Mm-hmm. And in that report, the new version of which is paid for to inform these policies, they wrote, journalism is founded on the principle that the public interest is best served by the public disclosure of the facts of civic life. That's a fancy way of saying something that you and I, as people in journalism, understand, which is like, of course the public should know what news they are paying for. And I understand that you don't make the rules, but by taking the job as board chair, like it does seem that this is an okay, at least an okay process with you, a legitimate process that you're okay to be involved within.
Well, I'm certainly dedicated to maintaining the integrity of this process to the fullest extent, as are all the members of the board. So I could say that personally, I would see the value of the argument of making that information public. You know, I'm in this role where I'm simply applying the act, and that's not within the role of the board to, you know, criticize the legislation or certainly not amend the legislation.
Okay. You know, I'm happy to actually have this level of just to get some answers. So I you know.
Sure.
It is your kind of marching orders from the guidance you've received that you can get rejected for things like if the original news content is not based on facts, multiple perspectives are actively pursued, researched, analyzed, and explained by a journalist. If the journalism is not produced in accordance with journalistic processes and principles, then you can be rejected and the government, you know, your recommendation will be do not give them QCJO status. I got that right?
Okay. We are held to the act, the words of the act, and we cannot disqualify strictly based on the guidance. So the guidance is really there to provide specification, interpretation, kind of, you know, getting more into the weeds, as you say. But we can't disqualify strictly based on journalistic practices and processes. It's really, is the content original? And is the organization really engaged in the production of this on an ongoing basis? So the examples I gave, we're not going to disqualify an organization because they're not doing investigative journalism. We're not going to disqualify an organization because they don't have, you know, three or four sources in each article.
Can you disqualify them if they publish fake news?
Well, of course, we can't do a full analysis of everything they publish for accuracy. That would be really beyond the scope of, we'd have to do like one organization a year if you were doing that. Independent research that has been done from other sources on certain organizations, we're certainly going to take that into account. But that, to this point, has not been, and I'm searching because, you know, last year we did 159 and we're doing some more this year. So I don't have all the cases in memory. But I would say that fake news is not it's a very rare occurrence in what we see. But again, we're not checking everything for accuracy, of course.
The conservative website, The Western Standard, has published an article about the process that they went through in applying for QCJO status. And they published the outcome and they shared the full outcome with me. Your board told The Western Standard that the board has serious concerns with the organization's journalistic processes and principles, particularly with regard to its coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. And your board called their stories incorrect or misleading. They had a story about how COVID-19 vaccines are experimental therapy that's being forced on the public by Big Pharma based on, quote, absolute lies. Your board was very concerned about a story that falsely reported that if people are vaccinated, they're more likely to get the Delta variant than unvaccinated people, which is false. Your board was really concerned about a Western Standard story about ivermectin as a recommended vaccine alternative. Like, the Western Standard had tons of misinformation about COVID-19 that your board was really concerned about. And your board found that the Western Standard ran that stuff, but made no attempts to question research or verify the quotes that they were publishing. And then your board approved them. You recommended to the government that they get government designation as a qualified Canadian journalism organization, which is the first gate they have to get through to then get salary subsidies and a bunch of other very, very beneficial programs. Can you help me understand this? And I understand that you can't talk about the Western Standard, but we can work with that. Hypothetically, why would a news organization that, in your board's expert opinion, has repeatedly misinformed the public about public health as serious as COVID-19, why should they get QCJO status and then get inclusion potentially and very likely in a big government subsidy program so that the taxpayer can pay them to make more of that kind of misinformation?
Well, I'm not going to comment on that specific case, as you correctly anticipated. I mean, when you talk about news that has to be grounded in fact and so on, you know, that certainly is a consideration. But this is not, this program is not designed to be hunting for fake news. Other organizations have published things that were inaccurate during the pandemic. And, you know, it's not our job to go hunting for that content.
But you found it in this case. And this isn't about an error. This is about a pattern.
Yeah.
When all these measures were introduced, one of the purposes, as I understood it, was real news is in danger and fake news is taking over. And the government's got to step in to subsidize and support real news. I don't think anybody would have wanted this program to ultimately be funding COVID misinformation.
Yeah.
So how could an outcome like this happen?
I can tell you in a general way that we look at the overall production. Certain organizations, and I'm not singling out the Western Standard, have produced content that has made these kinds of assertions about the vaccine and about alternate treatments, etc. We do look at the overall production of content. I don't think I can go any further than that.
It seems like you're saying that there is some acceptable level of misinformation that does not disqualify an organization from QCJO status. Like, is there some acceptable level of misinformation that you'll still grant? Is there?
You know, I would love to say no, but it's a difficult question to answer. Again, that's not our job to verify, to qualify.
I mean, you did say that their stories were false, so that it seems like you were taking on the role of making a judgment call as to whether this...
I'm not commenting that specific case. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
And it was a while ago. But, I mean, we're not allowed anyway to comment on specific cases.
Let me ask you a different question then. I appreciate the position you're in because you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you reject, then you are the news cops. If you accept, then you're creating a situation where government funding goes to bad actors and fake news, misinformation. That is why this
is... Yeah, and it's something we struggle with.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. So
you've got to make a balanced call overall. But of course, you are looking at a news organization at a snapshot in time. Maybe you look at their archives, but if you let an organization in, because let's say they only have 5% misinformation and the rest is good stuff, what happens if there's a change in editorial direction and they become a full-on fake news farm? Can they get kicked out?
That's a really good question because, you know, one of the issues with this program is when you give accreditation or designation to an organization, you know, do we have to review them every year? Do we have to?
Do you?
Well, so far, it's only the second year. So far, no. But there is a discussion and a process being implemented in terms of compliance. And that's something that's more of a long-term issue. So when we do issue serious concerns, to us, it's kind of a flag that these organizations might not you know, have kind of a free pass for I don't know how many years. But again, how is that going to be put into place? I could not answer. That would be more under the purview of the CRA itself, and they will probably not answer that kind of question. I don't want to speculate, but, you know, it's...
No, you're probably right. It's probably impossible to get... But what we can say definitively is that currently there is no oversight. Once you're in the door as a QCJO, the current state of things is that that's the status that you keep, and there's no process. There's no process.
There will be a process. But again, I can't certify that.
This is a really important point, because one of the key issues and why your board exists is that everyone agreed that the government should not be deciding who is a qualified journalist and who isn't.
Yes.
So we've got this board of experts and you're the chair of it. But when it comes to revoking qualified journalism status, one of the amendments enacted through Bill C-30 provides a mechanism for the minister to revoke an organization's designation as QCJO when the organization no longer meets the requirements to qualify as a QCJO.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's always the minister who decides, but we are going to be involved in that process.
And which minister are we talking about here?
Minister of Revenue. Uh-huh. Currently, it's Yann Le Boutillier.
Ultimately, you provide advice, but the minister decides who's in and they can say who's out. And it doesn't seem like there's anything here for them to provide any reasons why or transparency of the process or any kind of appeal. They can just say you're out.
Well, as you can imagine, this would not be the kind of process that would be taken lightly, exactly for the reasons that you know.
I take very little comfort in your, who knows? I don't imagine that the minister will do this. It would be pretty extreme, but... You know, the notwithstanding clause was never supposed to really be used either, right?
Well, it's a completely different subject, but...
We're talking about the independent press. We're talking about serious stuff, and we're talking about the independent press being dependent on the minister never using the powers that they currently have, right?
Not unilaterally. So if we advised her, or we advised CRA, that we think that this organization, its designation should be revoked... Well, then we are supporting that decision and it's no longer unilateral.
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything in there.
That's our role, right?
But you only provide advice, right? The minister does what the minister does.
Yes.
So far, has the minister ever rejected your advice or have they taken your advice every time?
To my knowledge, our advice has been taken every time.
I guess it is then fair to say that you are the board that chooses who's in, right? Like, you know, it's just advice, but it's advice that's always taken.
Well, there is an analysis that is done by CRA. And there is some back and forth between us and the CRA. So it's not like we have a right of life and death over these cases.
To return to our earlier point that there's some haziness around when you find errors or even misinformation, it might not be disqualifying depending on the overall picture. But one thing that I know from your guidance is that there is no tolerance for hate content. The quote is, publications used for the diffusion of hate content cannot be QCJOs. Do I have that right?
Well, that's, again, a legal requirement. Anything that's illegal will be.
Right, but there's a specific bit of guidance around hate content that the panel provided to your board. A few years back, the Toronto Sun ran a column by Sue Ann Levy in which she falsely reported that Muslim refugees who were being housed in the Toronto hotel were filthy, that the place had turned into a zoo, a madhouse, and that these refugees were slaughtering goats in the bathrooms. And it was all lies. And after that story ran, somebody tried to burn down that hotel with everybody inside of it. The National News Media Council called that column a serious breach of journalistic standards. For a lot of people, that would meet the standard definition of hate speech. Mm-hmm. Why should Canadians subsidize a media company that publishes hate speech?
Well, you're implying that it does.
I know that we subsidize Postmedia.
Yes. The problem is that we can't, you know, the board cannot go through all the content published over the last... Well, we do have a certain time frame.
Has hate content ever gotten a publication rejected?
I can't comment on that.
Huh.
I'm trying to remember the nature of the discussions we would have on that, but... The problem is also that we just can't pick up on all of the content. It's impossible. So we look at what they typically produce over the sample that we do have. And if we see that there's a systematic, hateful theme in what they're doing, well, then there's a red light that goes off for sure. But if it's like a, you know, one or two columns, I think there are press councils, there are other avenues to address these kinds of things for specific pieces of content, as opposed to what an organization is typically doing.
Yeah, but we live in a country where, like, somebody walked into a mosque and just opened fire. We live in a country where somebody just ran into...
That was in my city.
Yeah, I am not suggesting for a second that you don't care about this as much as any other Canadian. These kinds of stories can have real implications. I think if Post Media published stories like that again, which divide us against our neighbors and which do inspire people to do violence, I don't know that they're going to want to go to a press council. I think that if Canadians find out that they're paying for that kind of divisive, hateful content, they're going to go to the minister and say, I don't want to pay for this anymore. This is an outrage. There is no mechanism for the public.
I think, I'm not a lawyer, but I think the correct process here would be to have this determined legally hate speech. So then you need to go to court for that. And then
I think there's other...
If there is a court decision, because I'm not qualified to say whether something is hate speech or not. It needs to be decided for a court of law. So if that's the case, well, then we might have an argument.
Wait a second.
If there has been a decision.
Your guidance does tell you that if a publication publishes hate speech, they can't be a QCJO. So
yes. And whether it's hate speech is determined by a court of law.
Unless a court of law has determined it hate speech, you won't disqualify? Like, I don't think Rebel Media has ever been formally legally considered hate speech. So you couldn't disqualify any news organization on hate speech grounds unless a court has ruled on
a specific piece, on a specific piece of content.
This is really, really troubling stuff, Professor. Like, for the public to be funding that, sure, go to the courts, sure, go to the press council, but immediately it's okay for people in the public to say, I don't want to spend another dollar. I don't want my government spending another dollar on this. And there's no mechanism for them.
Oh, people are able to say that. People say that about the CBC all the time, right?
They can. And you know what? If enough of them were to get outraged about what they find out they're paying for, if they find it out, because most of these companies, we have no idea if they're being funded by the QCJO program or not. But if they do find out, I could foresee a situation where there is massive political pressure on the minister to use their powers to disqualify a news organization. So I don't know which is worse. It politicizes the news, right? Because there's no mechanism for people to say, hey, the board... Professor Brin's board missed something, or Professor Brin's board, they rubber stamped them, but then the publication became much more hateful. We want them kicked out. There's no mechanism for the public to initiate that. It's a totally secret, closed door process. So the only avenue is political pressure on the minister, who then has a mechanism to just throw out a news company.
I'm not sure I would put it that simply. I think there are other ways, but you do address something that is... You know, there is a part of reality in what you're saying, in the sense that we are unable to assess the full spectrum of what is produced in terms of content. We give an assessment based on a sample, and it's possible that we miss things. But in that sense, I mean, I don't see how it could be any other way. And we're not the journalism police. We are not a court of law which determines what is hate speech. We have a very specific section of the act that we need to interpret, and we have to remain within the confines of that. If there are concerns about certain publications, about certain organizations, those concerns are to be addressed in the proper forums. And I really sound like, it's awful, I sound like a technocrat, but it's the way it is. And it's important for a state of law in a democracy for things to be done in the correct way.
Professor, I don't want you to feel like you have to defend things that aren't yours to defend.
I appreciate your outrage, Jesse. It's one of the reasons I like talking to you. I mean, it shows that you have a soul. And I really appreciate it. And appreciate the conversation we're having, where you're interested in knowing about the process. I mean, very few people are interested in policy process, to be honest. And I hope people are not falling asleep as we speak.
Are you kidding me? This is fascinating.
It really is very reassuring for us to see how this is being carried out, and that there may be imperfections in the process, and there's certainly room for improvement. But overall, this program has certainly made a difference in helping news organizations survive the last couple of years, which have been extremely difficult for the economy in general, for Canada in general, but for media organizations in particular.
Professor, I do really appreciate the generosity with your time today. Thank you very much.
Well, I just hope that I haven't gone too far in what I've said as my role allows, but I've really appreciated this conversation. And it's given me a lot to think about as well.
Okay, that is the end of today's episode, but it was not the end of my conversation with Professor Colette Brin. Because what you've heard so far has been me asking questions from the point of view of the public, the news reader, of which, you know, I am one, but I'm also a news publisher. And this media bailout has implications, like maybe life or death implications, on every news company in this country, including Canada Land. When the government steps into an industry and hands out subsidies to some companies, but not all, that affects every company. And when the government gives a stamp of approval, deeming some journalists qualified and others get rejected or refuse to apply, well, that has impacts too. Other companies notice stuff like that. Google and Facebook, the platforms on which most people get news, those companies are noticing who gets government status and who doesn't. And next week, you're going to hear me talk to Professor Brin about that, as well as a lot of other people. But some of my questions can only be posed and should be posed to government directly. But before I called them, they called me.
All right, but before we go further, Jesse, sorry to interrupt. Do you agree that this is a not-for-publication meeting?
That's on the show next week. If you like this show, well, we have not applied for government media bailout support. We rely on your support. Click the link on the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. Our website is canadaland.com. And if you have not listened to the first episode of the new season of Commons, you got to do that. Their new season is about Canada's longest war ever, our war in Afghanistan. This is a must-listen show. Go check it out. This episode was produced with the help of Cassidy Villabrun-Barakis and produced with the help of Jonathan Goldsby. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and our technical producer. Our senior producer is Sarah Larniuk. Kieran Oudshorn is our managing editor. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Once again, if you like this show, we got a special thing going. We are the only news company in this country that relies on listener support, subscriber support, as our main revenue source. It is working. It needs more help. Go to canadaland.com/join or click the link in the show notes.